commenting.
Good morning, honorable members. The two entities of the Department of Economic Development, ITEC and the Competition Commission. We'll ask the competition to sit here because there's no one that will be sitting here. They can join us here. But we'll be starting with ITEC. And then you can follow up later. My name is Mandla Rai, R-A-Y-I. I always do this. I'm not Rai. I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Economic and Business Development. The committee oversights 6 departments and 31 entities. So the two entities are part of the 31 entities that we oversight. I will allow members to introduce themselves first, and then the two entities will do the same.
Good morning. My name is James Mtesa. I'm a member of this committee, the same committee that the chairperson is talking about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and thank you, chairperson. I'm Matofa Godihale. I'm representing Limpopo Province. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. My name is Moses Tetas Mplanka, representing Mpumalanga Province, a member of this committee. Thank you.
Morning, colleagues. Good morning. My name is Vusi Magwebo from the Eastern Cape.
Morning. My name is Jacques Lund. I'm here from the Western Cape.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, everybody. My name is Buyimo Ntebe. I'm part of the committee.
We'll introduce first the parliamentary staff. Also to introduce that Ms. Samila Pierre, who was the executive secretary to the chairperson, is now the executive secretary to the chairperson of the appropriations in the National Assembly. And Mrs. Pingise Kakaza, who is here with us, is now the executive secretary to the chairperson. Okay.
Good morning. I'm not the coordinator. I'm the committee secretary.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Philip Simela, GM Corporate Services.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Karina van Vieren, Senior Manager, Trade Remedies.
Okay. Competition Commission.
Good morning, all. My name is Tembinko Sibonakele. I'm the Commissioner.
Good morning. My name is Molate Kawi. I'm the CFO of the Commission. Competition Commission.
Morning, everybody. Ismail Hussain, BMG.
Thank you very much. Before we start, there's also an apology for Honorable Makoe. He has been asked by the Chief Whip to attend the Finance Committee. As we know that we're dealing with the medium-term budget, policy statement that we'll be adopting next week on the 5th. So that committee is busy with that process. I assume that the permanent delegate to that committee is not available, so he's replacing her. The second thing I want to ask members, if all members are going to continue with the meeting until we finish. The reason I'm asking this is the last meeting for the year. We have not been able to adopt the minutes. I think we have three sets of minutes that we have not been able to adopt because members will come but leave the meeting before we finish or before we get to that item. If we have apologies that are going to affect the quorum, then I'll suggest that we start with the minutes. But can I get an indication if members are going to continue until we finish the meeting? We'll probably finish by one because we have two entities. Can we agree that we'll continue until one, all of us?
If I agree, can I speak on behalf of everybody?
Thank you very much, Honorable Tim. Honorable Lont, you're one of the culprits.
I agree.
You agree? Okay, no, that's fine. So far, this is the only apology that we have, that of Honorable Makuwe. But in terms of the agenda, we'll be having a briefing by the International Trade Administration Commission, as well as the Competition Commission on their annual reports. After that, then we'll have the consideration and adoption of the first term committee program for 2018, and also the progress report on provincial briefing on ARTO bill. And then we have adoption of minutes, and then announcement on the change of date for the energy conference. Those are the agenda items for this meeting. Let me take this opportunity to welcome all members and the two entities, and also perhaps give this opportunity to Commissioner Tsengiwe to take us through the annual report.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, let me not waste time and go straight into the presentation. Those are the items that we are going to cover in the presentation. The presentation won't be as long as those items look, and so I'll be on time. We thought that since we are presenting for the first time to this committee, let's give some brief background of ITEC. ITEC was established in June 2003 to streamline, rationalize, and modernize an institution with a long history dating back to 1923. The commission is constituted of two full-time commissioners and 10 part-time commissioners. The commission is a body of experts that meets monthly to evaluate investigations and make recommendations to the Minister of Trade and Industry. We report to two departments, Economic Development and the DTI. Our core functions are tariff investigations. In tariff investigations, that includes investigations to increase import tariffs, to reduce import tariffs, and also we provide for rebates that have the same effect of reducing duties. It's a waiver on existing duties. Then we have three instruments under trade remedies: anti-dumping actions against dumped imports, countervailing measures against subsidized imports, as well as safeguards against a sudden surge of imports that cause serious injury to domestic producers. And then our third core function is on import and export controls that are on selected products for health, safety, environmental, and strategic reasons.
and so you may only import these regulated products by first obtaining a permit from ITEC. That is the snapshot of ITEC as a whole, linking our strategic objectives to performance areas and our services. Our services, again, under customs tariff investigations, it would be to look at increasing duties, reducing duties, and creating rebates. Under trade remedies, it's anti-dumping, countervailing, and safeguards. And again, under import and export control, we have these selected products that are under control. We also provide technical assistance to the DTI with regards to negotiation of trade agreements on those provisions that have to do with the instruments that we administer. And these would be with regards to multilateral, regional, and bilateral trade agreements. Those are our core business units. Tariff investigations, which is divided into two units according to the various sectors that are listed in the slide. In trade remedies, we also have two units conducting anti-dumping, countervailing, and safeguard investigations. Under import and export control, we have three sub-units. The first one responsible for the adjudication and issuing of import permits in terms of the regulations. The other responsible for export permits, and the third one responsible for the enforcement of the import and export control regulations. The Minister of Trade and Industry in the SONA debate this year provided a glimpse to the changes in the global trade policy landscape and on how South Africa should respond. The Minister has stated that as a small economy accounting for only 0.5% of world trade, if we become overly protectionist, we risk being denied access to other markets on whom jobs and productive sectors in our country depend. If we break trade rules, there will be consequences and we risk retaliation. But within these constraints, the emerging new circumstances call on us to be more resolute and indeed smart in advancing and defending our own national interests. On the next slide, we provide a trend analysis of tariff increases for the period 2003 to 2017, that is since ITEC was established. As you can see from that slide, from the 2008-2009 global financial crisis, there has been an increase in the total number of applications to increase import tariffs, as well as the number of positive determinations by the Commission, where the Commission recommended an increase in import tariffs. And this is explained by the tough market conditions as well as government policy. Those are the tariff investigations we completed during the year under review to increase import duties. We provide the specific companies, the subject products, most of which were steel products. Then on the next slide, we continue providing information on investigations completed, but this time on rebates. We had five rebate applications that were approved. In general, these approvals would be made in cases where there are no domestic producers of the subject products or the subject products are produced in insufficient quantities. Five of these rebate applications, as you can see, were declined in the main because these goods are produced domestically. On the next slide, it's tariff reductions. investigations completed, only two reductions in duty were approved in the financial year, and as you can see, the rest were declined. In general, duties would be reduced if goods are not produced domestically, which does not serve any industrial purpose. Instead, it just has a cost-raising effect. We also provide a slide where we show the location of the companies that have benefited from ITEC's instruments. As you can see from that slide on tariff increases, tariff rebates, and tariff reductions, Gauteng features a lot for obvious reasons, more than any other province. We at ITEC also administer the Automotive Production and Development Program, the APDP, the incentive scheme for the automotive industry, which is based on import tariffs and rebates. The DTI is the policy-making authority. Ours is to administer the program. In terms of the administration, you can see that we've been within our time frames in terms of the adjudication and issuing of the eligible production certificates. To participate in the program, you must first meet the criteria for eligible production certificates. We also provide information on the production rebate certificates, the verifications that we conduct under this program. In the next slide, we also provide the location of the OEMs, that is the original manufacturers, the towns and the provinces in which they are situated. The Eastern Cape is quite strong on automotive. The success of the automotive industry has been attributed to, amongst other things, the APDP, a clear industrial strategy for the sector. On trade remedies, we provide in that slide the trend in anti-dumping initiations. On anti-dumping initiations, as you can see over the years, there has been a decline. And in fact, in the past 3 years, 16, 17, and 18, we have not initiated any original anti-dumping investigations. And the constraints being the rules as well as the bilateral trade arrangement that we have with China. Our fierce competition originates from China. Continuing on trade remedies, we start with sunset reviews. Sunset reviews are conducted on existing anti-dumping duties. Anti-dumping duties have a lifespan of 5 years within which sunset reviews must be conducted or duties will lapse. And in that slide, we provide the specific products, the countries concerned against which we have anti-dumping duties in place. In the next slide, we continue with information on sunset review investigations carried from the previous year, the products concerned, and the countries. We also, during the year, conducted 3 safeguard investigations on frozen bone-in portions originating from the EU and on hot-rolled flat products from all countries and cold-rolled products from all countries. On import and export control, during the year under review, import permits were issued that amounted to 18,660. The majority of these permits were for the products listed in the slide: marine resources, mineral fuels, chemicals, rubber and tires, metals, capital goods, as well as automotive. Again, honorable members, these controls are for health, safety, environmental, and strategic reason. And further down in that slide, we provide a breakdown of the export permits according to the specific products that were adjudicated and issued in the financial year. As you may be aware, we have controls on scrap metal. During 2013, the Minister of Economic Development issued a policy directive directing ITEC to regulate the exportation of ferrous and non-ferrous waste and scrap, the intention being to promote scrap metal beneficiation and to reverse the decline in the metal fabricating consuming industry. The price preference system was set for a period of 5 years, which ends next year in September. Over the past 3 years, there are impact studies that we have carried out pertaining to support that we have provided on the listed industries, from parts for passenger aeroplanes to poultry to blankets and glass. These impact studies are conducted to gauge the performance of the concerned industries against the set policy objectives of promoting domestic production, investment, jobs, and international competitiveness. And so we take an outcomes-based approach to our instruments. Overall, the results show considerable gains in output, value addition, price competitiveness, investment, and jobs. On the next slide, we provide what we've been able to achieve against the set targets. As you can see from that slide, all the targets were met except for customs tariff increases and customs tariff rebates. As you may be aware, honorable members, the steel industry has been under a lot of pressure for the past 3 years. And in this slide, we provide an update on the support that we have provided as ITEC to the steel industry. In 2015 and early 2016, import tariffs were increased from 0 to 10% on a wide range of primary steel products following rigorous investigations by ITEC. The justification for this support to the domestic industry was the change in the global market conditions that saw the oversupply of steel resulting in low prices and increased imports into South Africa that local producers could not compete with. And so you may be aware of the difficulties that ArcelorMittal is facing, as well as Evraz in Mpumalanga. The Commission attached conditions to the tariff support for the primary steel industry, in which commitments were made by ArcelorMittal on fair pricing that would exclude the duties. AMSA also made commitments on production, investment, and jobs. All these commitments are currently being monitored by a committee of the Commission. Last year, we self-initiated investigations to look at increasing tariffs for the downstream that faces stiff competition from imports of their finished products. Rebates are also being created for the downstream in the case of specific products that cannot be manufactured domestically. And the challenge really with regards to the steel investigations that we've conducted has been to balance the interests in the value chain, addressing both the concerns of the upstream and and the downstream. Continuing on the support for the steel industry, recently safeguard duties, which is a different instrument from the ordinary customs duties, were imposed on hot rolled steel to be phased down over a period of 3 years from 12 to 10 and to 8%. Following these trade measures, we have witnessed a decline in imports of primary steel and increasing orders for the domestically manufactured steel. The structural business at Evraz has now been reopened and people re-employed. Jobs have been retained, although with some outstanding challenges relating to rising input costs, such as electricity and transport, and not so strong domestic demand, as well as the low growth rates. On the next slide, honorable members, you may also be aware that the South African poultry industry has also been under enormous pressure due to changes in the world market conditions and in particular imports from the European Union. Import tariffs on poultry meat were increased towards the end of 2013. We also show in that slide the companies concerned and where they are situated in the various provinces. The justification to increase import tariffs included rising levels of imports and loss of market share by domestic producers, decreasing profitability in the face of low-priced imports, price disadvantages, and input cost pressures. There are also anti-dumping duties on frozen bone-in chicken originating from the USA that were imposed in 2000 and have been maintained through sunset reviews. We have now finalized the investigation for a safeguard measure in terms of the economic partnership agreement with the EU. This is a safeguard investigation on frozen bone-in portions of chicken originating from the EU. Briefly on the support functions on human resources management, we provide services for staff that include health and wellness, training and development, as well as our performance management. We have quite a successful internship program. ITEC's workforce as at 31st March 2017 was 126. 70 of these warm bodies are in the core business and 56 in our support services. The vacancy rate for the period under review was 3.8%. With regards to corporate governance, ITEC as a public entity is required to comply with all applicable legislation and regulations relevant to the public sector, and we maintain effective internal controls which are designed to ensure that risks are reduced or managed and that the organization is able to meet its objectives. We have a well-functioning internal audit unit and a well-functioning audit committee. On risk management, ITEC has a risk management unit which conducts risk management continuously and also presents the risk register to the risk management committee for review. In terms of the report of the Auditor General, the opinion of the Auditor General was that ITEC obtained an unqualified opinion for the financial year concerned on irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. According to the AG report, ITEC did not incur irregular expenditure in 2016-17. There was also no fruitless and wasteful expenditure incurred. ITEC has developed an audit action plan template with actions to be taken in order to address the audit findings relating to compliance as identified by the Auditor General. Some of the weaknesses identified during the audit have been addressed, and there's constant monitoring of the activities which is still in progress. With regards to our financial position, those are our total assets and liabilities shown in that slide. The following slide, we provide a graphic representation of ITEC's liabilities. On the next slide, it's ITEC's total revenue, which amounted to 92.7 million. And in terms of our total expenditure, it amounted to 104.2 million, and so we had a deficit of 11.5 million, which was largely funded from our previously accumulated surplus. Contributors to the deficit include the following: increase in lease expenditure, salaries of contract employees for the scrap metal program, interns. So we are a bit under pressure in terms of the budget. In light of the fiscal constraints, ITEC has managed to contain costs on some of the cost items. We provide in the slide examples of those cost items where over the years we have been able to reduce significantly the amount spent. Lastly, honorable members, we have made a request to National Treasury via the Economic Development Department for additional funding. The basis for this request is that during the 2014 allocations, ITEC's baseline budget for 2015-16-16-17 was reduced by 4.8 million and 7.3 million respectively, a total reduction amounting to 12.1 million. Major cost items where funding is needed are with regards to rental. Rental has shot up at the DTI premises, the price preference system project, legal fees. According to the financial situation depicted above, ITEC recorded surpluses in 2012-13 and 2014-15, and deficits were recorded in 2013-14, 2015-16, and 2016-17. The deficits have been financed throughout these years from our accumulated surplus. It is also anticipated that a deficit will be reported in 2017-18, as the accumulated surplus is expected to have been fully utilized. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Let me also take this opportunity to welcome Honorable Farmer and Honorable Vauder. You're welcome. We will now ask members if they have any questions on the report. Let me indicate that only members are allowed to ask questions. Honorable Faba, Honorable Makwebu, Honorable Medjihal, Honorable Lord, in that order. Oh, Honorable Clark.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry for being late. Unfortunately, when flights come in, we cannot determine on how fast they're going to come in and how the highway will be on the way here. So if these, I should actually be on time, so I'm sorry for that. My question, Chairperson, luckily when I walked in here, I was listening to the presentation on the so-called Highveld Steel from that time. Now, I need to understand this. We had this discussion with DTI as well, and they raised the import tariff for cheap Chinese dumping of steel. But I need to understand, where is this like overlapping between ITEC and DTI? I just heard actually in the last week that Highveld Steel got the contract on railway lines, on the steel part, because it's the only factory, so-called in South Africa, that can actually make these railways, big railway, no, sleepers is the wooden part. What is
The railway track
itself, yeah. So, I need to understand, because I'm looking at the aim of the ITEC, and it is to develop in order to raise income and promote investment employment in South Africa. What have they done when the Chinese were dumping steel through Eskom with a power plant that's been built. Why didn't they jump in at that stage already to save our fuel industry? Why did you wait till then? Why not at that stage already save our fuel industry? In coming to tell us that so many jobs are created, you're not understanding how many was lost, unfortunately. And this is my question. Why didn't ITAC, is it your responsibility or was it DTI's responsibility to see it that our parasitals actually use steel from South Africa instead of the Chinese dumping? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jefferson. My concern is just the DTR, you said at the end there, because that seems like that's the big thing that caused your deficit, is the extra rental. But I don't see that you drastically increased your staff, so why do you need the extra... why was that increased so significantly by the DTI? Because you've got the same amount of area that you're using, so it's one of your own companies or mother departments that's actually pushing that up so much and it's getting you into this difficult situation.
Perhaps the other question related to that, Mr. Lord, would be Mr. Spingo was saying that they report both to the EDD and the DTI. But in terms of grant, it comes from EDD. What is the financial contribution of DTI, given now that they're charging you for using their premises and at 56, is it 56% increase? I saw something in the in the document itself, around that. No, I was just trying to elaborate on the question of Honorable Launch. Honorable Makwebu.
Just two things, really. One, I just want to express my appreciation through you, Chair, to the ITEC for their good financial performance, you know, the financial year. The reporting on, and it's indeed appreciated. You know, it's other departments are battling to get you know, good reports from the AG. But that is it. My questions are the following. One is on the issue of slide 15 and 16, the poultry industry generally, you know, that is deboned meat or what, you know, chicken portions or what. We have been advised. As you know, that the poultry industry is under stress. We're shedding jobs, and that's my focus, where my focus is. I see, you know, trade remedies. You have a report that is, you suggest that it is at the final stage. I want to know what you mean by final stage. Can you give us clear timelines in the next 3 months, 6 months? Because this is what DTI has been saying. You're saying the same, that you're looking at trade remedies, because a lot is being said. Some people suggest that this is probably technically, you know, a dumping of chicken from countries that are heavily subsidized, and they dump it to South Africa. That's losing jobs. And some people are saying it is not anti-dump, it is not dumping, but it's just an issue of competitiveness. So be that as it may, we need clarity on this issue because we're losing jobs and we need to move on and save our poultry industry that is seriously under stress, and we're losing jobs. That's the first question. So what is the timeline? Secondly, Chair, I want to refer to slide 34 and 35. Let's start with 33, actually. 33, you've spoken about requesting assistance from Treasury that they should, you know, inject more resources, financial resources, to you guys because of the reasons they have explained. But amongst the reasons that you have explained, I'm at slide 35. Yeah, slide 35 to be exact. Amongst the reasons you have explained is that you you want to deal with the issue of legal fees, that is litigation. I want to talk about that, and I want to focus on that. I want to know, what is your litigation profile? Why are you concerned about litigation, and how much relatively would be, if you are able to give us the figures? Are you prone to litigation? Are you the one who's litigating? Or are you defending, cases against you? Can you just give us an idea and a sense? Because it's kind of like vague from where I'm sitting now. So I would want you to break it down for us if you can. If you can't, through your chairperson, that information must follow. We want to understand their litigation profile. And lastly, we'll be back to slide 33, the issue of the causes of your deficit, which you've used your surplus from the previous financial years, to fund. But again, be that as it may, because amongst the reasons you have mentioned that led you to the deficit was the contract workers that you've employed, or metal, contractors. Now, why would you employ contract workers if you didn't have a budget for that? You had to go, you worked on a deficit. And I want to know, was it really necessary to do so? And if so, could you please advise us what could have been the reason to do that? And Chairperson, let me pause and afford another member the chance whilst I'm thinking. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Maybe we're still going to be offered for another round, because we are still making some research on this. It has to. Chair, perhaps my clarity seeking question will be on issues of employment profile in detail, in terms of your gender and your balance, your gender imperatives, your males and the women, your race, as so on. And then two, perhaps also to be given detail in terms of the weather, in terms of women in the executive, how many more women do we have in your executive, and because we believe that women must be prioritized most of the cases. The other one, Chair, perhaps is just to get the know-how, because the presentation is very broad, Chair. Of course, we must welcome the presentation. Just to know on in regard to empowerment of the triple B companies, your entrepreneurs, how do you actually, how many companies have you so far empowered, and what is the progress, and in terms of the current your particularly on your emerging companies, leave the main already sustained companies, because I believe you do have already sustained companies that you are working with, but I mean mainly on your the emerging companies. What is the progress there? Are we achieving in terms of the funds that is put to empower this company? Thank you.
Just before Mehdi Khali, I always encourage members also not to only rely on the PowerPoint presentation, that they should also have the book on the annual report, or some of the issues that are raised by the Honourable Shamla are contained in this book. This is just a summary that is taken from the actual book. So if you can also talk to your secretaries to make sure that you get these books, so that you don't only rely on the PowerPoint presentation, because on the issue of employee profile, it is contained here. Issue of gender, they are contained in detail. For instance, the females are 56% of the workforce, and also there's a race profile and job profile. I'm not responding on behalf of the entity, but I was just indicating that in addition to the PowerPoint presentation, you must also get the actual book. Similarly, with the Competition Commission, they also have this book that you must also go through. not only rely, because sometimes they will summarize and leave out some of the information. So that's why I always focus on the book, because I also have questions that relate to finances Honorable Makwebu, that you're commending the entity on, but there are issues that are not in the PowerPoint presentation that are contained in the book itself that I will be raising. I'm not criticizing you, so you don't have to respond to what I'm saying, but I keep on encouraging members to always do that. Next year we'll be dealing with the APPs. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you got the book itself on the APPs, and then you can listen to the PowerPoint presentation.
Chair, I'm not responding to that, Chair. Just to put emphasis on it, as we are putting an order that we should be assisted by our secretary. Can the committee support staff assistance in particular those books? Because we are always raising that question, and yes, we may not know how to get those books. But can our
Martin is responsible
yes
for that. He must make sure that he puts in your pigeonholes these particular documents. But also your own secretary must also liaise with Martin Erasmus on that. I'll come back to you, Honorable Faber, but I had a list, Honorable Medical.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the word of advice. Even though I really want to say the Honorable Chairperson will remember that in this house we are jack of all trades and we have so many committees. Sometimes it is even hard for us to go through that, but it's not that I am trying to respond to what you were saying, but I just want to say that and also to apologize in advance if ever I'm going to repeat what the other honorable members did repeat. I really want to join my honorable member, Makwebu, when it comes to the AG's report and congratulating the ITEC people for really receiving their unqualified report. Even though when they were doing the presentation, Chairperson, it came to my mind that one day in our NCOP, one other member just said, sometimes when their numbers are not corresponding, they cook the books. So I say, I'm sure these ones did not cook the books so that the AG can give them a qualified report. That was just on a lighter note. But I just want to comment on check slide number 35. Though the chairperson, you did touch on it. Normally when we come across the issues of finance, we normally bargain. I don't know whether the ITEC did not try and negotiate with the DTI, because you cannot just have an increase of more than 50%, and in this case it's even 56%. Just want to check if ever they did ask the DTI to go down a little bit, or did they just say, no, we'll go to Parliament, they'll give him us money, then we'll take it to the DTI. If ever they did not do that, I would encourage them to go back to the DTI and ask that they should at least go down so that all these things mustn't be heavy on their shoulders. Even if their budget can end up being approved, Chairperson, but they cannot just work for the other department. We approve and they take the money to the DTI. It cannot be right on them. Slide number 25. From the beginning, I've noticed that there are provinces that the ITEC were doing the investigations on. But here they're talking about training, development, and performance. I just want to check if ever this training, when they are trying to address the skills, they only consider these three provinces, or do they go all over provinces, including my province, Limpopo? Just want to check on that. If ever they are not doing that, I would want to know why are they not doing that. And normally when the people have worked, Chairperson, they will need the rewards. But ITEC here is saying the ITEC has non-economic awards in recognition of excellence for its employee. I just want to know why, because if they were having that rewards, I think it will then
make sure that the employee put more efforts on what they are doing, knowing that at the end of the year or a half yearly time of the year, they will then come and receive the rewards. But if they are not giving them the rewards, don't they think that they will end up demoralizing these people? My last question, Chairperson, is on the tariff investigations. I just want to check with the ITEC, if ever after their investigation, are they getting something? Do they find these people whereby they end up paying something? If ever they do get that, normally if I am being found guilty, sometimes I'll pay something, I'll be fined something. I don't know whether it's good English, because Limpopo is a rural area. We don't even have anybody speaking English in that province. But if ever you understand me, you just come in and help me. If ever you get in some fines from after the investigation, what do you do with the money? Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just also like addition to my first question, on the Competition Commission, you actually just touched on that.
No,
what I want to know, because we've got ITAC, we've got the Competition Commission, we've got DTI, I don't know if they're overseeing the whole process. What I need to know is who's playing the guitar, especially when it comes to this dumping of steel, chicken, cement, etc. Because there are percentage tariff increases supposed to protect our own industry. Now, I need to understand this, because I am not a subject matter expert on this, so I just want the clarity on that, because we can maybe take them on, and maybe it's the Competition Commission. On the other side, the Minister of DTI is deciding he's the one that's playing the guitar. We need to understand these things, and for that reason, if I can just be enlightened. Thank you, Chairperson.
Most of these entities were under DTI before the establishment of Department of Economic Development in 2000. So there will always be that link between DTI and EDD and the entities. Honorable Vauda, and then we ask Mr. Tsengiwe and his colleague to respond, and we'll then, after the response, give you another last round for follow-up responses, and then we close, and then we go to Competition Commission. So you're the last on this first round, Honorable Vauda.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I greet you all with Assalamu Alaikum. In between being late and having some enjoying some niceties here that have been prepared by our support staff, I've been looking through the document, but I missed some. So maybe I don't know that this whether it has been covered, but I humbly believe I don't think so. What is of concern to me, Chairperson, is increasingly, you see with this poultry industry, the issue surrounding the poultry industry, this issue surrounding the steel, increasingly we are finding that the agricultural industry in this country increasingly is moving towards crops that are more valuable, that will bring in greater amounts of profits. But this, unfortunately, is at the expense of the production of cash crops. It is at the cost of contributing to the food basket in the country. Now, the issue that is of concern to me is that as we increasingly move in this direction, we will find increasingly we will have to be importing. And that will place us again at the very similar type of issues that we are find now relating to the poultry industry and the steel industry. The question that I'm asking is whether you, as ITEC, whether you have identified this, has the department identified this as a potential problem in the future, and as these problems arise, they cost us jobs. As we lose jobs, this causes increasing
poverty, and this causes increasing discrepancy in the socioeconomic circumstances of people. So has this been identified? Do you see it as a threat? If the answer to that is yes, what are you doing about this? If the answer to it is no, then will you then please, as a department, as an ITEC, raise it with the department, raise it with other groups, so that this situation can be addressed as a matter of urgency? You know, I'm thinking of the, for example, the sugar industry, which is massive. It takes up huge amounts of land. It also takes up huge amount of water resources. But what does it really do to contribute towards our food basket? Very similar with the wine industry in the Western Cape, or the macadamia, growing macadamia industry in this country. And it's in this light that I'm asking the question. Thank you, Acting Chair. Is the Acting Chair there? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mavda. Can we give the Commissioner to provide answers?
Thank you, Chair. We are going to share the questions. Philip, our general manager, will attend to the questions on the rental, as well as the contract workers, and the question on our employment profile. Karina will address the question on the safeguard investigation on poultry, the process and the stage that we are in now. Chair, with regards to the first question by Honorable Faber, what is the role of ITEC vis-a-vis the role of the DTI? We should have been quicker in saving the steel industry. When the Economic Development Department was established, the administration of our finding legislation, the International Trade Administration Act, was divided between the two departments. In short, the administration of the Act is with economic development, except for decisions on tariffs and trade remedies. So when we do these investigations, we make recommendations to the Minister of Trade and Industry. However, the rest, in terms of funding, strategy, reporting, policy framework, that's with economic development. Now, the DTI, as the policy maker, they developed a multi-pronged strategy to intervene to address the crisis in the steel industry. That multi-pronged strategy includes trade measures, what ITEC is responsible for. But in that strategy, there are other elements. For example, the competition issues that have been addressed by the competition authorities, issues with regards to public procurement, the designation of steel for local procurement, that's the responsibility of the DTI. There are also issues with regards to input costs, the administered prices for the steel industry. That would include electricity. So that responsibility of the strategy is with the DTI. We are responsible for implementing some of the elements. There is a process that we follow when we make these interventions in the various sectors. It's a process that we must follow in terms of the law, in terms of how we conduct the investigation. It takes 6 months to do these investigations to increase, for example, import tariffs. But for sectors in distress, we've shortened that to 4 months, which can be quite tough. The challenge is that in all these investigations, in the value chain, you have different and conflicting interests. And so it depends where a particular business is located in that value chain, whether it's primary or downstream, which is where the issue of litigation comes in. So the nature of our business is such that as a result of the outcomes of the investigations that we conduct, there will be winners and losers. It's inevitable. Take the case of poultry. We would investigate to increase import tariffs to protect the farmers and the processors domestically from low-priced imports in order to retain and create jobs. However, importers stand to lose, importers of the low-priced imports. And so in all these investigations, you have this contestation. And so some of the losers would take us to court as an institution on questions of process and methodology. Since our establishment, we have been in court, that is High Court, the Appeal Court, and the Constitutional Court around 28 times. And 20 times the cases were ruled in our favor, and 8 times they were ruled in favor of the litigants. So that's where the legal challenges come from. There was a question by Honorable Wouter with regards to concerns around steel and poultry, in particular concerns around the agricultural sector. The strategy of government is to maintain primary agriculture whilst promoting processed agriculture, agro-processing. That's the strategy. So that you have value addition domestically for the domestic market as well as for the export market. And so for the vast majority of agricultural products, we have protection in place. We have import tariffs, be it primary agricultural products or the value-added products. Some of the products you mentioned, sugar, wine, and nuts. The biggest challenge with regards to this sector globally is that industrialized nations hugely support their agricultural sector. They pay huge subsidies to the farmers and the processors. From our side, all we have are import tariffs. We don't have any subsidies for the sector. And so we would use these trade measures to level the playing field for our domestic producers. Without that, then the domestic market would just be taken over by imports, resulting in loss of production and jobs. With regards to the question on empowerment, the BBBE, the services that we provide, increasing tariffs, reducing tariffs, rebates, anti-dumping actions, these would be based on applications that we receive from industry. And once we have that support, it would be applicable to the whole industry. If it's poultry, it's the whole of the poultry industry, whether small, medium, or large, or black-owned. So in that manner, we wouldn't have a criteria in terms of our instruments that discriminate accordingly. But in terms of the normal procurement of goods and services, I mean, we follow the applicable framework as ITEC. Currently, we want to take the question on the safeguards on poultry from the EU.
Thank you, Chief. I think there were two poultry cases that we refer to, that you referred to in your presentation. The one was against the US, the sunset review that we are in the process of finalizing. It is with South African Revenue Services, so we're just waiting for them to publish. So it's completed, but for the publication. The safeguard investigation in terms of the EPA agreement, we completed our investigation and we gave the minister our proposal. There has been two rounds of negotiations that the DTI has led with the European Union in terms of the EPA. So basically, the whole process has now been completed. Minister must just make a decision now.
Thank you, Chair. I will start with the question of the rental. Why significant increase in terms of the rental? We are in the DTI campus. According to the DTI, the average monthly amount for the space, the whole campus, it's about 15 million per month. And that means the average per square meter is about 578. In our discussion with them, what came out is that the DTI is still subsidizing us. And according to them, they were heavily subsidizing us. That's why they had to increase to that particular amount. Even though the increase are substantial, they still, according to what they've given us, and these are just figures of 14 and 15 for 15 million per annum, they are still saying that they are heavily subsidizing us. From 2014, before 2014, we were paying about 3.2 million per annum. After their 56% increase, it went to 6 million per annum. Now there's also an increment of about 10% per annum. That on its own makes this amount quite substantial to our budget. Also, the issue of the contract employees. In December 2012, ITEC received a draft policy from the minister to strengthen the current export control policy by introducing PPP, as that is price preference system for the exportation of ferrous and non-ferrous scrap metal. Now, as a result of that, there were eight contract employees that were hired. Now, from 2012-13, we only received 4 million rand for only the salaries of these contract employees. Now, this actually means the vest has been catered for by ITEC from our expenses. That as well contribute to that. The next thing what also contribute to our deficit is that our stipend increase at the rate of about 5% each year, but the percentage that is negotiated by the DPSA for staff increases per annum is always in the region of 7 to 7 point something percent. That means over the years we are going to have that deficit actually growing and growing. That is why we have actually requested additional increase from Treasury. Now, the other question was if there were any negotiations with the DTI regarding the rent. We've always, the rent issue has been with us for, I think, more than 5 years now, and our last discussion was earlier this week, where in fact we were discussing with the DG of EDD, and asked all the entities to give a motivation as to why we the benefit of leaving the campus versus the benefit of staying in campus. So this is the matter that is still ongoing. In terms of the litigation, Now, the Chief Commissioner has already alluded to the fact that ITEC operates in a litigious environment, given the different and conflicting business interests in its investigation. In 2014, we've received about 4 notices of motion, which we all of them were successfully defended by ITEC. However, a number of these cases were again appealed by respective applicants in 2016-17, and some of these cases are still going. If we look at our legal fees, that amount moved from 2.2 to about 3.4 million, respectively, in 2016-17, which is a 53% increase. And that is just a sort of a snapshot of our litigation issues at ITEC. The other question was the question regarding the employment profile. Chairperson, thank you for responding on our behalf on this question. Yes, it is true that the females, we have 56% out of 131, 56% is probably around 60-something employees who are female, and 44% are male. Now, if we move up in terms of the senior management, senior and executive management, we have about, as at the end of 2016-17, we had 6 members of senior management who were women, and we have 9 members as men. But to date, the figures have actually changed. We now have 2 additional women in senior management position. That means we have 8 now as women in the top echelons, and 7 as men. The other question was with regard to the non-economic reward. I must say that this does not mean that we do not give bonuses when bonuses are due to those who are deserving members. But this is just a mechanism from ITEC as management that we are showing appreciation to our employees. So we actually believe that not only financial rewards are the ones motivate staff, but the non-economic rewards that just to publicly honor those who are top performers within the institution. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Philip. There was this one question on what do we do with the funds after the investigation. We don't charge as ITEC for our services. So from the beneficiaries of our services, we receive no funds. There are no funds after we've completed our investigation. Thanks.
Thank you. I think while you were talking about legal fees, Philip, in the annual report, there's something that says that referred to the legal fees. It says that the matter relating to legal fees has been referred to the National Treasury for advice on how to treat it because of the use of it. Can you elaborate on that, Chair?
Thank you, Chair. Now, as ITEC, we do not procure the services of lawyers. For every case that we have, we get the services of the lawyers from the Department of Justice. Now, given that a substantial amount goes to our legal fees, the Auditor General raised a query that it seems like we are not following the procedures, procurement procedures. Accordingly, the Department of Justice
does not follow the normal procurement processes, but is getting quotations. They have their own way of doing things. But however, that according to AG is our responsibility, which we did not agree to that, because as an entity there is no way that we can tell a department how to run their own procurement processes. Hence in the we have taken this matter back to National Treasury for advice. And to date we have not received anything. The last comment was last week where they actually said they will come back to us. That is the matter.
So then this query might then continue in the future.
Now, our question to National Treasury was that it's not only ITEC that is procuring the services via DOJ.
Yeah.
Now, whatever is happening at DOJ should really not be ITEC's issue, because if we are supposed to get legal services from a department, that's all we're going to do. But as to what happened in the background within the department is something that we don't have that control unless we stop completely from going to the Department of Justice, which can be another query that we are now using private sector legal people as opposed to using the Department of Justice. So whichever way you look at it, if we cut completely from going to DOJ, it's still gonna be a query. But if you go to DOJ, their own processes were questioned. But because the money that we are paying, the legal fees, comes from us. In fact, we don't even pay directly the lawyers, but we pay DOJ. Then the DOJ will then pay those lawyers, which, except for them doing our business, that is defending us, we don't really have that much control as to who gets appointed or not.
I just check if this query has it has any impact on the AG opinion.
Yes, because if you look at in the opinion there, ideally we're supposed to have received a clean audit. Now, for us to receive a clean audit, our finance needed to be materially free of any material misstatements. In terms of the compliance of the legislation, we were supposed to be as well free from material misstatements and performance information as well. Now, there was only one issue on performance information where it was found that one indicator out of 28 was not smart. Now that is the only thing that was raised that made us not to get a clean audit. However, in our report there is this thing of non-compliance with our procurement with procurement processes, which directly means that we are not following procurement processes when it's not ITEC but the DOJ.
Okay, is the Auditor General referring to this on page 46, I think item 22?
Yes, on item 22.
Financial and performance management.
Yes.
Is referring to that particular issue?
Yes.
Okay. And on leadership, on the same page?
On leadership,
item 21.
I think AG have just one template, one wording that they use. If there's something that they find, then the leadership will always be there. So there's nothing specifically that they can say that we did not do A, B, C. But because, according to them, there were some findings, therefore, ultimately, the leadership bears responsibility. And the findings also include the one of the DOJ.
But it says here the leadership of the entity did not always exercise adequate oversight responsibility.
Yes.
In certain instances regarding financial and performance reporting
as well as related internal control.
Performance reporting is, I've mentioned that one indicator was found not to be smart. Therefore, if you look at that statement, it sort of tried to say overall, because there were findings in performance reporting, there was also finding in compliance, so that actually is a statement referring to that.
So while I'm still on that area of the AG report, I'll come back to members. I just want to clarify this. The issue where you say in the PowerPoint presentation that there are no irregular expenditures, but then in the book itself, there is an irregular expenditure that was written off. We decided to write it off. It says it's not condoned, but written off. We decided to write it off.
Okay. The annual report is for 1617. That is not something that was incurred in 1617. It's something that came in the previous year, that is 1516, where we've had a fraudulent activity where somehow the banking details of one of the suppliers were fraudulently changed, not inside, from outside, an amount of about, is it 100,000? About 100,000 payment was made. In terms of the amount, I may be corrected there.
Now I'm referring to this one of the
364,693 on page 79 on the annual report. When I look at the previous report, it talk about a decision, the person who had points, more points or high points was not appointed. That's what it says in the previous annual report.
Oh, okay.
But then you say that has been written off. The authority decided to write it off, but it is not condoned. So I want to know who took that decision to write it off.
Okay, let me explain it. The one of 300 amount that is showing there, it's, even though it was declared as irregular, it was a situation whereby we went through the normal process of procurement, and out of the three service providers that were bidding, the cheapest did not really comply with what we wanted, but they were the cheapest, but the second cheapest complied 100%. Now we then called these suppliers just to verify, to ensure that as suppliers they'll be able to do the work. After that process, we then appointed the second bidder, who then went on to do the work for that particular amount. But however, according to AG, that was not the correct way. In actual fact, they said we have added an extra requirement which was not on the original document. That's the one of calling service providers, three of them, and asking them to do a presentation. That amount was regarded as irregular. Now, according to the rules, irregular expenditures, you know, it needs to be condoned, and it also needs to be, at some point, be written off. Otherwise, it will still be on our document.
My worry is that who took the decision, firstly, on the issue of the procurement, and then who took the decision on the issue of writing off. My worry is that of a player and the referee situation. I'm concerned about that.
Okay. We have the committee, the price quotation committee, took the decision to make that appointment. Now, once the appointment had been done, and it was found to be, you know, the cost related to that was found to be irregular, then another process, which is financial process, needed to follow.
and ultimately it ends in the accounting authority writing that off. And we also have to you know, notify treasury of that. That's a treasury process.
Where are they informed?
Yes.
Then the last one is the one that you were talking about.
It's on page 73. Loss arising from fraud, 189,430. I assume that you were referring to that
yes.
one. Can you then again tell us what happened?
Elaborate. I think the issue was when the accounting details of a service provider were fraudulently changed. That was just a scam from outside. The way it was done, you had to be a forensic expert to see that was not the case. So once the accounting details were changed, then the normal payment was effected, and only later when the VL service providers were querying why the payment was not made, did we realize that it was paid erroneously or fraudulent activity occurred. Now, that we went through the process and we've opened the court case, and to date we have not made any progress. The SAP has not made any progress in terms of that.
Do you have the case number for this?
We have the case number. I may not have it with me, but yes, we have the case number for this.
Can you provide us with the case number so that we can also follow up with the committee that is responsible for SAP? Okay. With regard then to the HR issues, you talk about internships and the placement of about 19%. How many people are you talking about? Because you know, in your preamble, it's justifiable. You talk about the issue of unemployment, particularly the unemployed graduates. Your role that you play there. And I see that in the presentation, you're talking about only four people.
Well, with regard to the internship, the issue here is our financial position. Depending on our financial position, we were able to take a certain number. And initially, we took about 15 interns, and many of those interns were able to get employment within and outside ITEC. But to date, we are left with about four interns. Now, the issue then becomes, given our financial situation, whether going forward, would we be able to take more interns or not? Which is a question mark, because unless we can get proper funding, then we'll be able to get more interns. And to be honest, at ITEC, most of our interns were able to get employment within the year, not only at ITEC, but also outside. But because of funding, we are at the stage whereby maybe next year we may not continue with the interns.
Then internally, with regard to training and development, do you have, in terms of your workplace skills plan, career cutting within that, where a person who came as a sweeper move up the ladder to become a manager? Do you have a career cutting?
Okay. Well, I cannot specifically point out to one who was a sweeper and became a manager, but yes, we do have situation where, in most cases, some of the interns, as we speak now, are actually senior investigators, because they came in as interns, they went through the processes, and they went up their ladders. At the moment, many of them are investigators.
Let me go back to members and give them a second draft. I just wanted to clarify some of the issues that I pick up from the report. Mayor Dikhale, any other hands? Honorable Bauda, Honorable Makwebu, Honorable Ntebe. So those Honorable Mslanga. Oh, okay. The four hands. Mayor Dikhale.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is not a follow-up question. I did not hear them responding on the issue of addressing the skills gap.
Can you note the issue of the skills gap? Honorable Bauda?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Regarding the gender balance, I must express my admiration for the ladies in this organization. But I'm also a little bit concerned what's happening to the men, you know. Don't they have any, okay. Chairperson, the question that we raise, and I don't wish to labor a point, but the response given it actually highlights the concern that I have. You know, what we are seeing is increasingly in the agricultural industry, crops that are being planted are crops for export purposes, and then we would have to increasingly import, and then import tariffs, and we reach the situation again like we've had with the poultry industry. So the question I'm asking and the concern that I have is what is being done to ensure that increasingly we will not see the agricultural industry move in that direction, which is compromising the contribution to the food basket. An excellent model to look at is the model being used in Morocco. For those who might be interested, you can Google it and look at what Morocco has done regarding the agricultural industry and exports. If you need to know more about it, and if you cannot find it, you can contact me and I will give you more, but I'm not going to bore everybody around the table with that. But it is really a very interesting model that they are using in Morocco. Thank you very much, Shepard.
Okay.
I think the team is well abreast with the issues, but I just, as a way of comment, want to speak on probably one or two issues. Now, you're playing a critical role in the space that is so paramount to the economic development of the country. And we're struggling with our trade balance as things stand. Because we are a commodity export-driven market, low commodity prices have also affected us so much. But for years we've been speaking about the diversification of the our export materials. And we've not been able to zoom into that space. We've been trying to say tariffs are going to be the space within which we want to mitigate against such issues, but I don't think we're making necessary progress. From where you're sitting, are there any legislative framework that you would need us as politicians to probably speak to? What are the shortfalls in terms of what the provisions are, so that we can probably assist the commission in making sure that the work continues. But as things stand, we are standing on a fiscal cliff as a country, budget deficit is growing, our GDP debt is growing way above 50%, way above the norm, whether continentally or internationally. And there seems to be no immediate steps in the immediate to cap such a runaway fire. From where you're sitting, tariffs plays an important role in this case. So what are the shortfalls? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. You know, when the Chairperson was raising a few issues, you know, something crossed my mind. about your internal controls. You know, one transaction you said is with the police now, where banking details of a supplier was changed, and you suggest that you hold the view that one must have been a fraud examiner or forensic expert to pick that up. But the money was paid from your side, no doubt. But who tampered, who changed the banking details is still to be discovered or to be found out by whoever is investigating, hopefully the police. But be that as it may, in your presentation you've indicated that you've put up an action plan to address, namely, the following, the shortcomings raised by the AG, its findings, as well as to deal with your controls. Now, through you, Chairperson, I would want you gentlemen to share that action plan with us so that you can see what is it that you're doing, you know, to strengthen your internal controls. Because surely these issues of these fraudulent cases and suppliers paid, you know, they in one way or another, they speak to your internal controls. And now that you've got an action plan put in place, we'll want you to share that with us, as well as what you're doing to address any and all other issues that the AG has raised. Can that be my request, Chairperson?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Chair, man, I was saying no, I was going to not ask a question, but now since Honorable Mkwebu has asked on issues of the action plan and the control issues, the internal control plans. My question, Chair, I just want to know in regard to the corporate issue. I mean, the serious stealing of copper stealing, and what measures do you have to assist the SAPS in keeping this situation? Because I mean, it has escalated since we passed the bill on copper legislation. What is your action plan? What plans do you have to keep this scenario?
Thank you. And the team, maybe starting with the issue of the skills gap that was asked by Medihan.
Thanks, Chair. There are no skills gap internally within ITEC, if that's the question. We don't have internally a skills shortage to carry out the mandate. We select the best amongst the young graduates when we recruit. We have an on-the-job training program as well as outsourced training for our investigators, if that was the question.
My question comes from slide number 25 under training, development and performances. I wanted to know because from the investigation side, you are only mentioning three provinces. So I wanted to check if ever, when it comes to this one, do you consider other provinces or do you only do the skills training gaps only on those provinces?
This is training for our internal staff.
Oh.
Yes.
So do you see that you are doing the training then?
Training for our staff, yes, as indicated on slide 25, the slide you are referring to.
Mm. Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Honorable Vauda, I guess you were making a comment that we should also have a look at the Morocco model on agriculture. But again, in terms of government strategy, the goal is to maintain both the primary and secondary agriculture to service both the domestic market and export markets. Which market producers prioritize is a business decision. But we will have a look at that.
model of Morocco.
There was a question, Chair, that we have been struggling in terms of our trade balance, which is true. There's been improvement in terms of the trade balance from deficits to now surpluses, but the concern is what's on the export basket. It continues to be dominated by commodities. So the challenge to further diversify the real economy remains, but we are relatively diversified, especially in the continent. If you look at progress we've made in various sectors, metals and engineering, automotive, clothing and textiles, plastics, etc. But there's more that needs to be done to incentivize diversification. The question you were raising on the fiscal cliff, that's a big question for ITEC. It's a macroeconomic question for government, and it can only be addressed through increased economic growth rates. There's no other way. The economy must grow at very much higher rates than what we have currently. And then there was a question on copper theft. When the minister directed us to restrict the exportation of scrap metal, it also includes the exportation of copper scrap. I guess the stealing of copper finds a lucrative market when sold abroad. There are premium prices for scrap metal abroad than what the scrap merchants would obtain domestically. And so the thinking was that restricting the exportation of scrap metal would also have a positive effect of discouraging the theft. But as you were saying, it remains a challenge. In the final analysis, it's a criminal matter, which is for the police. The law must be enforced, but we are involved as ITEC together with SARS, working in close collaboration with the South African police. Philip, do you want to, was there a question? Oh, okay, on internal control.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The question was to share with the members our audit action plan. Before I go to the audit action plan, the key issue was the issue of the fraudulent change of our banking, of a service provider's banking details. Now, before a service provider's banking details can be changed, there are certain information that is required by ITEC for us to be able to effect that. And one of the key information will be a letter from the bank authorizing original letter from the bank. And when the details of the said service provider were changed, every information that is required by ITEC was provided. And when we looked at the details, it looked so legit that you would not see that it was fraudulent. Now, that's where our internal control failed us there. But since that year, which is something that did not happen in the year that in the audit year that we are reporting, it's a year before that. Since that year, we are no longer accepting the details electronically. Number one, we want, if there's going to be a bank detail change, we want an individual that we know that we're dealing with to come in person, and the document should be original as possible. Now, we've also added another with the help of the bank, another security feature where the bank, before we pay, the bank will then send us a proof that this is the relevant service provider. They're linking the account details and the company. That seemed to help quite a lot because we, since then, we've never had any of such happening again. Now, in 1617, there were about eight to ten findings overall in our annual report, and four of those were technical in nature. But if I may start with the one that I've already reported on, where an indicator was found not to be smart. What we have done, we have put together a technical indicator description that actually explained exactly what was the intention of that particular indicator and how are we going to measure it going forward. That's number one. The issue of the legal fees, I've already commented on that. And there were some findings, for instance, of, you know, operating lease have been classified as finance lease. Those were technical in nature, which is just an interpretation, you know, financial interpretation. One saying this is the lease, this is operating lease. Another one saying this is financial lease. So those are the key findings I can think of on top of my head that we've actually dealt with. Thank you, Chair.
But the point remains, if you can switch off your mic, that there are two issues that you must provide us. The court, I mean the case, and the audit action plan. So those are the two that we will require. Let me take this opportunity to thank you. I hope that all the questions have been responded to. Good. Thank you very much, Mr. Tsungiwe and the team, for availing yourself and giving us the report. Thank you very much. We will now go to a competition commission. We have a competition of our own now between you and us in terms of time. We only got 1 hour, both of us. Perhaps as you continue, Mr. Wolanga, with your presentation, you might anticipate, given the questions that have been posed to ITEC, as you continue, you may be able also to address those issues, particularly those that have to do with HR and finances as well. But I know your AG report on you is a clean audit. Perhaps just if you can grab something as you go out there. Thank you very much. Over to you, Mr. Wonare. Because we only have 1 hour now to finish everything, we are at your mercy now, Mr. Bonaga. I don't want to limit you in terms of how long you should take in terms of the presentation, because
It would be unfair because you've been here since 10. But by 1, we should be done with everything. I'm sure there will also be fewer questions on your side. That's why I was saying that you must also preempt these questions, particularly on governance. Yeah. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. We have already introduced ourselves. These are the four areas that we intend to cover in our presentation. I really do want to spend a little bit of time explaining the work that we do. So I will introduce the organization and maybe go straight to item four with your guidance now to deal with organizational and financial overview, and then I'll come back to the content of the work just in case I don't have time. Chair, the Competition Act was promulgated about 17 years ago. So it's one of the post-apartheid institutions established in terms of the Competition Act. We are the Competition Commission, and we are one of three bodies. The other body created by the Act is the Competition Tribunal, as well as the Competition Appeal Court, which is a court presided over by Judge Dennis Davis. And we are like the police and the prosecutor of the system in that we are the investigating and prosecutorial arm, and we prosecute cases before the Competition Tribunal, and any appeals from that go to the Competition Appeal Court. So that's largely the structure, and we do our work through four instruments. That is not in the slide, but if you look at the work that we will be talking about today, it really falls into four categories. One is what we call measure regulation. So when there are measures taking place that meet a particular threshold, they have to be notified to us. We can either approve measures or we may block them if they are going to lead to anti-competitive effects, or if they will have what we call adverse public interest outcomes. And those could be employment, adverse outcomes on employment. Those could be adverse outcome on an industry or region. So that's our major regulation, and this is a very high-level summary of what we do. The second area, big area, is what we call enforcement. This is where the Act just prescribes what would be transgression. And key amongst those is what we call collusion or cartel. This is price fixing, this is market allocation, and this is bid rigging. We investigate and prosecute those. Another species now we're looking at very closely is what we call abuse of dominance, where a dominant firm does certain things to either block other people from participating in the market or exploiting consumers. Those we can investigate and prosecute. The third area, so we have measures, we have enforcement. The third area, which is new as a result of the latest amendment to the Competition Act, is what we refer to as market inquiry. This is where whenever there are negative outcomes in the market, we can go in without pursuing a particular firm. We just see outcomes, either high prices or no entry or exploitation of some kind that's anti-competitive. We can go in and find out what exactly is going on and come up and make recommendations either to the government for regulation or to the industry itself to change. In some instances, to the regulator. So the example of this, which we're currently doing, is the inquiry we're doing on data services. Data services, we're not accusing anybody. We're going in there because everybody complains about high prices. So our recommendations could either be to ICASA, they could be to government, or they could be to the industry itself. The related area is that of advocacy. This, again, for us is very, very important, because advocacy is where we advocate for voluntary compliance. So this is where we talk to business, but we also talk to government, because a lot of anti-competitive effects actually emanate from government regulation. So government regulation is a very, very big issue for us. We look at regulations and what they are intended and unintended consequences. So, Chair, this is a very, very quick introduction to our mandate. We have developed a vision which is that of regulating for a growing and inclusive economy. I'm back to the slide now, slide four. So our strategic goals are as listed there. They really focus on competition enforcement and major regulation. That's our core mandate. And this year that will also include, this was last year, this year that will also include market inquiry, because as I said, it's a fairly new mandate. The other one is strategic collaboration and advocacy. We recognize, I mean, it was so good to sit here and listen to our colleagues from ITEC. We recognize that to deal with economic problems, you need more than one instrument. So you will see, I will be discussing steel, and I could also discuss poultry. In fact, I can discuss any sector that ITEC has been discussing with you. But without collaborating, you are going to have different outcomes and misalignment. So we take effort in engaging with our colleagues who are dealing with economic questions, industrial policy people, and even people who manage state-owned enterprises, because they play a big role in the economy. Transnet, mover of goods, and managing our ports, very, very important for our competitiveness as an economy, and also competition in the economy itself. So that's a very, very big area of us. And then lastly, we also strive to be a high-performance agency within the state especially. So this is where we deliberately pursue excellence. And let me then, Chair, jump and go to the slide on the organization. I think that would be slide 20. No? I will tell you now. That is slide 30. Now, I hope you have page numbers there at the bottom. this is really the organizational profile. I won't take time on it because the numbers speak for themselves. As I have said, we are a post-apartheid institution. Our demographics reflect that. We've never had to go and try to change an organization from a transformation in racial lines or even gender lines. So we're fairly balanced. Our numbers reflect the demographics more generally. This doesn't mean that we don't have challenges. With time, I could share a lot of these, Chair, but maybe one that I think is big is this area of skills. In competition law, there are skill shortages, not only at the Commission, but in the country. So, for an example, when we are looking for people who are economic experts, often we have to go to Europe at huge expense. We do have some capacity in law. Our lawyers, I think, are amongst the best in the world. But for them also to get into this field takes a little bit of transition. So where do we recruit our people? We take graduates, just like ITEC, and try convert them into the specialists that we want. And I would be very proud to report to you, again, anticipating the discussion that you've had with ITEC, that our graduate training program, which is also fairly extensive, has really yielded positive results. In fact, the Deputy Commissioner of the Competition Commission came from the ranks of this. We produced members of the competition tribunal, again coming from the ranks of this since we were established about 17 years ago. So we grow our own trees because we can't find them to harvest, and that really has been the remarkable journey of the commission. So if there is anything we have achieved it through the people we have developed ourselves. And I'm particularly proud that we have a very young, vibrant graduate coming through the ranks even today, black professionals who are experts in their own field. In fact, the private sector is the one that's poaching from us and really setting us back from time to time. On the finances, again, I'm going to be moving very fast. The point, though, I think I should highlight is that we are also getting into a very tight budgetary situation. In the previous year, our revenue actually decreased by 2% from 295 million to 289 million. And we have seen a decrease, particularly from a government allocation. We have income that comes from major filing fees. So when people file fees, we charge them. And this has been increasing over time. But expenditure has been increasing far more than income. Expenditure increased by 71 million from 296 to 367, reflecting an increase of 24%. We incurred a deficit of 78 million compared to last year's 1.2 million. And at that time, this was perhaps not too big a problem because we had accumulated surpluses we were funding most of this from, which are now depleted. Let me pause, Chair, and just say that we have a program of increasing the work and capacity of the Commission, which program is supported and is in line with government policy. So we are increasing the numbers of our staff as well as the level at which they are. So in other words, we want to be able to have internally within the Commission experts who are able to appear in court, testify, or lawyers who are able to run our own cases without outsourcing. So there is an insourcing strategy, but that also comes at a cost. I'm anticipating your questions about what caused this increase in expenditure. That's largely the growth of the organization from what was roughly about, I think, not so many years ago, about 120 employees, to where we are standing now of about 220, and we are looking at increasing that number in a three-year phased process to about 400 people, which we think is an optimum number we can work with. Again, this is not something that is a new. We've been working with the department on it. We have achieved, as you have indicated, a clean audit. I'm very happy with how we have managed our resources in the previous year. I don't want to be triumphalist. I mean, we are striving to always be better. And this is not to say that we have never had issues. So indeed, if you were to look at the previous years, we've been working on issues, particularly the area of procurement, and we've made quite advances there. We also have things that we are monitoring coming from the Audit and Risk Committee as well as AG itself. One of the things that they have highlighted was that we didn't have enough people to deal with procurement. So we have employed a specific head of procurement who can look into that area. I think this is an area of continuous improvement, but I'm happy again to take you through some of the detail. I've spoken already to the next slide. So the only thing I want to highlight, Chair, is the AG's finding, report actually, on the viability assessment of the Commission, where he states that if the trend continues, that is of spending, the Commission could run into problems with solvency of business and in meeting its payment of obligations. I should say that this was, of course, at the end of the financial year. If I may update you right now, is that we have reached that stage that the AG warned about. I have written to the Minister of Economic Development. A letter I would be more than happy to share with you, as well as the Minister of Finance, where I highlight this in a formal way. I've been engaging with the Minister of Economic Development for some time, but I've raised this now in a formal letter, saying we are reaching a sort of spending crunch at the Commission. You don't want to be in a situation where all you do is to pay salaries because you don't have money for projects. And as I have indicated, there are specific things that we have been required to do in terms of government policy, which we aren't able to do given where we are. On number 28, Chair, this is our budget. With your permission, I'll skip this. There's nothing controversial about it. The issues that I've explained are just reflected there in numbers in terms of what we generate ourselves as fee income, as well as what comes from government allocation. The only update I can give you there, which has happened now, is that the Minister of Economic Development has increased fees. So the power to increase fees that people pay at the Commission lies with the Minister, and we have made this motivation before. So at least there's going to be a little bit of a relief there. We are anticipating that we will be able to raise just under 80 million from the fees, which will reduce again that gap between our expenditure and income. Yes, the filing fees have now been increased. So those numbers are starting, you won't see them here, but this financial year they are starting to close the gap a little, but the deficit will still be there. I've given you also a three-year sort of budget in terms of what is the total expenditure likely to be and what the projected revenue and therefore what would be the required funding. These are big decisions that government must make in terms of its priority. So if government wants to prioritize competition policy, we've given a plan to say this is what it costs. But there is also good news, which is that in reality, the competition authorities, you will see when we go through our cases, that when it comes to the fiscal, actually we are self-sustainable. Because the more prosecutions we make, the more fines we generate. We are not there to pursue revenue by fining people, but just by that act of pursuing investigations, we get more money, and that money goes to the fiscal. And I was explaining this to the Minister of Finance, that I'm not going to increase your deficit, actually. If anything, the impact the Commission has on the fiscal is positive, not negative, because the more money you give us, the more money we generate in penalties. But obviously that money doesn't come to us, otherwise we would have perverse incentive. We would now pursue people for the sake of raising revenue. So we understand that. But if the Treasury people who are looking at income were also talking to the ones who are allocating, they actually would realize that it's a no-brainer to give us more money. So let me go back to then the cases, Chair. This is where I think we would be flexible in terms of time. So I'll take your guidance. If you feel like I must slow it down, I will. But I'll try to touch on the highlights that would make this hearing worth a while. Let me talk about steel in a few minutes, because actually for us this was the biggest area of activity in the previous year. We settled our long-standing case against ArcelorMittal. I think everybody in the room knows the history of ArcelorMittal in South Africa from its days when it used to be ISCO and was state-owned, eventually being privatized and to a current position where it is largely foreign-owned, owned by a Mr. Mittal, who is based in London. We've had problems for many years with this company because they have been charging local customers, the South African customers, what we call import parity price, a price that reflects what the customers will be paying if they were to import steel, including transport costs from Richards Bay to wherever the customer is located. Now, those costs are not incurred, but that's the price. So if I was, ArcelorMittal asked, if I were not to sell to you, what would it cost you to bring the steel all the way from wherever you can find it in the world to where you are located? And that's the price you pay. And this practice was justified on the basis of convenience, that, well, we provide convenience, we have security of supply, we are here. In fact, customers who were able to demonstrate to ArcelorMittal that they have alternatives. So a customer who says, I can use steel, but I can also use plastic, they could discount to those customers. So it depended on whether you were really dependent on them entirely for your business, and that would determine the price. So there have been years of investigations and litigation against this firm. That's why, actually, when there was talk of localization, we were one of those who were opposed to have them benefiting from localization, because the benefits of that would have gone to the shareholders. There is an issue of jobs that gets raised all the time, which we are sensitive about, but there is also a risk that we may be blackmailed when it comes to this issue. Because people do all sorts of things, but when you pursue them, they say, well, we'll close down the factories. So when there was an increase in steel from China coming in certain markets, we had a funny way of disciplining arms, because they started engaging with customers now to say why they should not import from China. And so we had to engage with ITEC about how they phase in tariffs. So we went product by product. Where we saw that South African producers were exploited, we said, please don't impose tariffs on these ones, because we want them to still compete. But where we saw that the imports were decimating our local capacity, we said, well, we don't mind. You can impose the tariff. So I think it was a very interesting case study of a collaborative effort. It was made possible because AMSA was in trouble, I should also admit, because they also came to negotiate with us now to say when they go to government, they can no longer get assistance. They cannot get assistance because of all of these cases that were pending. And so we reached a groundbreaking agreement with them, which included the highest penalty we ever imposed on a company of $1.5 billion. We also agreed that in good time they would limit their EBIT margin to a cap of 10% for flat steel products. these were where we found that most abuse was experienced. We also got them to commit to 4.6 billion capex. Let me just pause again and talk a little bit about the problems of steel as we see them as a competition commission. And I, again, respect that, you know, when there are trouble, there's trouble. You see ministers working very hard to save the existing jobs. And I think it's their function. But also we must look at long-term sustainability of industry. One of the problems of South African steel palace, whether you talk about AMSA, Van der Vale Park, and everywhere, or Highveld, you must go see them. They are old, these plants. There has been no investment for a very long time. You can't compare them with the new steel plants you find in China and everywhere else. So they are not going to be competitive. In fact, it would have been interesting to ask ITEC what happened to imports after they had imposed tariffs. In many items where they have not been competitive, they are still not competitive. Those imports still come. That's why they want protection on localization, because localization forces a buyer to buy from them, whether they are competitive or not. Now, I'm not saying let's do away with localization. I think it's good. But also we must watch that we should not be encouraging firms not to invest and to just extract rents from captured customers. Because that customer, by saying it must only buy from the single local producer, that customer is captured. It cannot do anything else. What incentivizes then that producer, Highveld or AMSA, to be efficient? Nothing. They keep taking the money to the shareholder. All what they show you is that my factories are still running, I still employ people. As soon as those factories are uncompetitive, they'll dismiss those workers. So the issue we are dealing with is how to ensure that it's sustainable. And it's an investment question. They have now accepted that their plants are old, and that what we don't have in South Africa is what we need is investment in improving their plants. So that's why we said we are going to impose a fine, but we would not want the fine to get you not to invest, because there was a risk that they pay the 1.5 billion, but they simply take it from CAPEX. And then it's a vicious cycle. You still have these plants not being competitive. So we think that this settlement will lead to the reduction in prices, but also the overall improvement in the competitiveness of the industry. So I will just pick that sector, Chair, in the interest of time. That is the area of enforcement where we pursued them for abuse of dominance. Let me now just touch in the area of mergers, particularly on public interest issues. The last year saw the largest merger ever notified in the competition authorities in South Africa with the sale of SAB Mila to Anheuser-Busch InBev. This case was very interesting in the sense that at face value it didn't present any competition problem, because SAB was already dominant in the South African beer market. In fact, their market shares are in excess of 90%. I think in the competition sector there was an expectation that we will simply approve it. But there were a lot of things that came up during the investigation, some competition related, but some public interest. The one interesting thing was actually the alcoholic beverages market in South Africa was cartelized under the apartheid regime. There was an agreement that allocated markets to SAB, which was given beer, Distell, which was given spirits, and some wine, and there was also a third company which was meant to be dominant in the wine sector. And insofar as they wanted to then get into these other areas which were not allocated to them, they had to reach agreements with those who were allocated in those areas. So in other words, we have historically inherited this, and it's been difficult to break. And one of the relationships that have troubled us is that exists between Distell and SAB Miller, because Distell produces a lot of cider, which is the fastest growing alcoholic beverage market in South Africa. But they had to sell this through SAB InBev, through SAB Miller. And as a result, we saw the chilling of competition, because we believed actually that Distell could easily enter the beer market itself, because it had the distribution capacity. The only reason it was not entering was a result of the historic cartel. So we used the opportunity to address that, and we ordered them that AB InBev must sell its shareholding in Distell within 3 years after the deal. They also own, if you want to produce any beverage where you need crowns, you buy them from a company that's owned by SAB Mill. So if you wanted to produce cider, if you need a crown, you must go to them, they must supply. And that is a problem. So we agreed that they should continue to supply the tin metal crown to third parties for at least a period of 5 years, and that they also must allocate at least 10% of their fridge space to SMMEs. So what has happened in the industry is that they supply fridges to taverns, and then the tavern doesn't need to buy any other fridge, but you can only stock their product and put in that fridge. And so it means that there will never be entrance. So if you have a local brewer who does cider or whatever, they can never be able to get access to market. So part of this was to address that. And we had an employment condition where we put a moratorium on retrenchment as a result of them. In fact, we said they should not retrench as a result of a measure. And lastly, we also asked them to create a 1 billion rand fund for development of agriculture over 5 years to promote entry and growth of emerging and black farmers. What we found here, together with them actually, was we have conditions to make us a net exporter of barley and hops. Currently we are a net importer. So there are regions in the country where it's possible that we can be a net exporter. And we asked that this fund be channeled towards that. Historically, SAB had grown its own barley and hops. And we said this in fact, is an opportunity for them to invest in the emergence of an independent farming community. There is a long-term structural change that would lead to, in the sense that if you now have independents who produce barley and hops, again, you don't need to go to SAB Miller to be able to get this input. If anybody wanted to enter the market and they are independent farmers, you can enter. So we were trying to open up space there for entrance. I will not discuss this merger, but just to highlight that we did block a merger in the mining sector, which was a merger into a monopoly. So one of only two firms who produce andalusite in South Africa wanting to merge, and they appealed this all the way to the Competition Appeal Court, and the court agreed with us. There have also been a lot of cases that clarify matters in the court, really advancing the scope of competition intervention. So, for example, in fines, so people, when we pursue a cartel, there are people who go to a cartel meeting. You know, if you look at slide 13, people who go to a cartel meeting, this was a bicycle cartel. We import bicycles in South Africa. It's largely wholesalers who import and then they sell to all of these retailers. So the retailers clubbed together to force the wholesaler to prescribe the price at which they must sell bicycles, because they said that they were competing profits away. Now, one of the retailers who participated in the meeting said, "I said nothing in the meeting," and we prosecuted them together with the rest of the people who were in the meeting. And the court again ruled in our favor, saying that if you are in a cartel meeting, you have an obligation to tell the authority that a cartel took place, or at least publicly distance yourself from the meeting. So there were a few cases like that, cases like when can we pursue, for example, the parent company if the subsidiary was involved in a cartel. The first inquiry we did under the amendment on market inquiries, I explained the function of market inquiries earlier, was on an inquiry we did on LPG. We have finalized this and we made recommendations which were tabled in Parliament earlier in the year. We have that report as well, Chair, should the members wish to have, but it's also available in our website. I will give you just a very short summary again of what we are finding there. The first problem is on regulation. LPG is regulated, and there is a lot of duplication and sometimes confusion as to who regulates what. So NERSA regulates infrastructure, but also if you are going to import LPG, at the port authorities regulate that. And sometimes you get concessions and licensing over infrastructure that do not talk to, that are not in sync with one another. You get a concession to import given 10 years, then you get a license to build infrastructure by NERSA, which gives you 5 years. You can't make good investment decisions when you have that. So one of the recommendations is that government must streamline regulation. The other thing is there is a regulated price for LPG, which is not enforced all the time, because in winter you're finding that there's a lot of abuses. And in fact, we found that in the department there's only 9 inspectors to monitor compliance with this, which on average we said is about 1 inspector per province. Now, this is a problem, and we have recommended specifically there that we think that maybe it's better for the agency, that is NERSA, to be given the mandate to do the regulation and develop capacity. But all of those are now with the Minister of Energy for some action, and we have some timeline. The other main issue is that LPG in South Africa comes from refineries. You will recall that we only have about 3 or 4 major refiners in South Africa. And they have exclusive contracts with wholesalers. So they give almost everything to a particular wholesaler. Wholesalers would be the guys in the middle. They would include Oryx, EasyGas, or Afrox. We find the bulk of the gas in South Africa, LPG, will be supplied to these through long-term contracts. The problem is that with a structure like that, you'll never have entry. So one of the things we've said is that they must then dismantle terminate those long-term agreements and start supplying emerging suppliers. Increase, I think they are now supplying less than 5%. Increase that over time. And we've given all the information to the energy department so that this could be monitored. On our side, if these contracts persist, we have said that we will launch abuse of dominance investigations against the incumbent. So right now we want them to voluntarily terminate and allow entry of emerging wholesalers. Let me also stop there. I will discuss in case there are questions. Chair, we've done an impact assessment on our intervention. This is also another new area we're doing. Saying after we do all of these things, what happens to markets? And there are interesting studies we've done on once we broke the monopoly over infrastructure of telecom, because we did that in about 2008-2009. What happened to that infrastructure? And there are many positive results that we see on internet service providers and so on. Again, let me not spend too much time, but I would be more than happy to talk to that. The other highlight for 2016-2017 that I think are important for MPs is we've now seen an introduction of criminal liability for collusion, so price fixing, market allocation, and bid rigging are now a criminal offense as from 2016. I should say that this is one of those things, again, where legislation needs to be meshed with resources. Because once you threaten to send people to jail, they put a lot of resources in defense. In fact, you will battle to get them to court easy. So in this case, we have a situation where we have promulgated the law, but also the institutional mechanism of holding people accountable are not yet where they should be. Let me not get into details on this. I've shared this with government as well to say what is it that needs to be done to send people to jail. Because members of the public are coming to me all the time saying, you are always charging 10% fine. Can't you count beyond 10? Actually, it's Parliament and the executive that can help in this instance. But I've got proposals, Chair, I can elaborate on should it be necessary. I should also mention that we're doing a lot of work in the BRICS community with our counterparts. We have learned a lot of things from BRICS on how to open markets. China has opened a lot of markets for SMMEs and the informal sector. The people who supply components, car parts. You know, in South Africa, there's an issue that if you have a component that doesn't come from the OEM, then naturally that component is inferior and is going to impose some risk on you if you buy it. But there are regulations. You can assess the quality of the parts and see if they are matching the OES. And fantastic work has been done in different countries, India, China, and even Russia, on how to open up components for supply to OEMs, but also for people who are just maintaining and servicing their cars, including the workshops. Now, in South Africa, we have motor plants and all sorts of things that forces you to go back to the OEM to maintain your car. In many countries, this has been done away with, including Europe, by the way. In Europe, to buy a motor plane is an option. And you know the price of a motor plane, because a motor plane is not a free gift. There's a charge for it. In South Africa, you don't get told how much you are paying for it. But after that, you are not told that you are going to be locked in that motor plan for 5 years, however long it takes. When in fact the car needs very minimum maintenance. As soon as it needs maintenance, you're out of the motor plan. So what is the cost of this is not clarified to consumers. So we have a major project, which as I said, are insights from our counterparts, major project to open up that market, and I'm sure you will see details of that as we go. Chair, I don't want to take all the time for questions. Maybe just the last highlight to make, only because I know that it's also going to be a big issue in January, school uniform. We've had a major campaign project on school uniform. Schools, particularly former Model C schools and some private schools, but also you find this in some township schools where they prescribe uniform that will only be supplied by particular suppliers. And so people don't want, for example, to prescribe an ordinary shirt and a gray trouser. They want certain things engraved and all sorts of things. What we're saying is that if you have insignia, whatever you want to put on uniform, just make it affordable for parents. You have a possibility, and we're seeing this in certain areas, where there are even local co-ops that produce uniform. Because the way you prescribe it is going to have a huge impact on who makes it and supplies it. So you have a lot of schools with a shop within the school. This is where we really need assistance from everybody on the ground. Because these school shops are in fact the conduit through which this exclusive supply and massive profitability takes place. Sometimes suspicious relationships between school management and these suppliers. We've brought this to the attention of the Minister of Basic Education. A circular has been sent to all the schools to revise how they prescribe uniform. Uniform should be as generic as possible, and uniform should be supplied more generally by suppliers without limitations as to exclusivity. If people want to send their kids to very expensive schools with a particular expensive uniform, it's fine if you do that. Some private schools, but public schools must be accessible, and accessibility includes the cost of uniform into these public schools. By public schools, I mean I include Model C schools, which often impose a prohibitive cost for people to get into these schools unnecessarily. Chair, let me end it there. I know I can talk for a long time about this thing. I have hardly touched the surface.
Thank you very much. This was a really interesting educational as well. If I had powers, I would even ask that in presentations such as this, we should perhaps set a day, whether it's Friday, to have this kind of presentation in the form of workshop, not in the form of asking the entities to account for purposes of information sharing. Without wasting any more time, I'll ask members then to ask questions. I'll start with the Honorable Lord. He raises the hand even before the presentation was made. Then Honorable Fafa. Let's start with the Honorable Lord.
There's a very interesting thing in the news now about the proposed merger between SAFE and Airlink. But my question is more towards South African Airways and the continuous bailout that they do get, which creates an unfair, in my opinion, but I mean, have the committee or the commission looked at it to see whether that is creating a fair market for emerging airlines to come into, where they need to compete and South African Airways keep on getting these bailouts? And if you haven't looked at this industry, why haven't you looked at it?
Baba.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like first to start just by asking that we get written answers on our questions if we're not going to get to the end of it, as there are some of this, and I would like the presenters to please take it down so that we can actually get the written answers, as I think some of it is quite important. Just to add on what Honourable Launce was saying there, I know Comair had this case against SAA on subsidising. I understand that there was quite a nice fine of 45 million against SAA. I would like to know also what happens to that fine. Where does it go to at the end of the day? Then also there's a thing of the Vodacom abuse of dominance after this exclusive contract with National Treasury of 20 government departments. Subjected to the new Vodacom contract. I want to know about that, if you can enlighten us on that, if it is fair against all the other participants. Then lastly, and I think one that no one's talking about, but which is also in the finance industry, and I want to know why the Competition Commission, at the Client Standard Bank's group's request to release details on its investigation into currency manipulation. This has already started in 2015 when the Commission alleged that firms including JP Morgan, Case and Paribas and Standard Chartered colluded to rig the value of the rand. I want to know why the Competition Commission has declined to release details on such investigations. I think that is very important. We cannot just see that they refused to give the outcome of this. This is not on. We are here as Parliament. We want to know why. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Oh, I thought
I'm not sure why you're so generous today, but I'm impressed. I'm impressed nevertheless. You're in a good mood. Chairperson, two things really. One is on page 30, slide 31. You've indicated that there's an increase in your expenditure of 24%. I just wanted to find out, what are your cost drivers that are causing this significant increase? And lastly, will be on slide 36, you've spoken about the investigations that you are conducting. Now, I want us to focus the investigations to, because I know you're conducting various investigations, but let's focus them on those cases where, you know, in those instances where there is a criminal case or potential of a criminal case. Now, the question is, how do you conduct the investigations? Do you conduct them solely using your internal resources, that is, using your internal investigation team, or you are using what is now the best approach, in my view, the multidisciplinary approach that all other institutions are using? And I'm sure you understand. I see you nodding, and I will appreciate your response to that. Thank you, Chair.
I think I must be upright. Commissioner, this is one of the most underrated commission. Great work to be done. Unfortunately, you don't have favor in the media space. If you get coverage, it's going to be on page 13 somewhere there with a small caption on what you do.
Gerard, your question is?
Don't be bothered, because sometimes when we talk about coalition and cartels, you would understand why such questions are asked. I was one of the people, Commissioner, that from the position of the unknown, very critical about penalties that you impose. I felt that, one, they are quite not significant. They are not assisting in terms of mitigating that the recourse is made, but also they don't enforce consequence management on the part. You would understand that you are not dealing with people who are vulnerable. You are dealing with people who are possessing capital, and capital is social power. And as and when you pursue them, they also have the financial muscle to take you to town and back. But I thought that if you do, because I see this, that you are intervening on behalf of the vulnerable, and if there's going to be fines that are going to be imposed, there must be some level of comfortability from those who have been exploited, that at least there seems to be mitigation process in place. The second issue is, yes, I know that this issue of this SA link and this measure will come to you. But I want to urge you that this is one of the space that is not, the penetration or affordability of people has not been accepted for quite a long time. And it's my view that if there's going to be anything that needs to be done in this space, is to make sure that affordability becomes an issue. Not just that people want to capture the space, the sector that they operate, and therefore they have the financial muscle. And I have been following the issue of SAV Mela with caution, because there was also a public outcry about how are you going to handle it, looking into the displacement of labor as one, which was avoided in all costs. And I think from the position of labor, there was jubilance in terms of how was that handled. But it's still an issue. It's like what you are talking about in terms of the school uniform. My 11-year-old boy goes to a public school, but I'm forced to buy from only one designated provider. And if I don't do that, my boy will not be allowed in school. It's a reality. And who's the provider? It's not a previously disadvantaged South African. So I relate to what you are raising, because I'm also in that process. And I can assure you, even though the basic education minister has communicated in a formal of a secular, I can tell you now, I can bet the last Zimbabwean dollar I have, SGBs are going to take you to town and back about their responsibility to decide. I'm telling you. So it's not going to be a rosy situation that a secular will just go out and people will comply. And I can tell you, you can go to the most rural part of this country. You will find cooperatives that are able to do uniforms that are of international standard. As to why they are not used, you don't understand. So I just wanted to say, Commissioner, I think the work has been done. I think you don't have favor in the media space. I think in terms of your communication models and all that, if there was something, I think the issues of finances, we should be able to, on our part, to be able to put pressure that such a critical component should be adequately resolved. Because I know that every money that you generate as a revenue generation mechanism goes to treasury. So if there's anything that can be done, it needs to empower you so that you continue to do work. But you can't do work if you are under-resourced, and that's the issue. But from where we're sitting, there's a raging discussion in the political cycle, in the public discourse also. Why do you refer to cartel corruption as collusion?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me really join you in congratulating the Commissioner when it comes to the presentation. I also noticed that no one was dreaming or thinking, closing their eyes, because you make us, all of us, open our eyes and our ears. Thank you very much for that. I want to congratulate you on the clean audit, and also to request you that you continue to keep up the standard, and also to congratulate you on continue to chair the ACF, though my question is, well, even if you are saying plainly that you're supporting Nigeria in the development of competition legislation, I just want to check, are you only supporting the Nigerians, or are there other African countries that you are supporting, or are those countries not needing the support? If ever they are not needing the support, when are you going to end up supporting the Nigerians? My colleagues were specific on the industries when they were asking, for example, the issue of South African Airways. I'm not going to be specific. I just want to know under general as to what is it that you're doing with the penalties. For example, on slide number 16, on the compliance and litigation, you are saying that administrative penalties for last year amounted to 338 million. I don't know whether these penalties goes into your coffers, or you'll clarify me on that one. Why do I want to know on this one? Because of this issue of school uniform. From where we are coming from, the people are, the parents are really suffering. Let alone unemployment. We know that our people are not employed. So my question is, why don't we have at least a stake in all the fines that you'll be getting in order to support all the rural areas with free school uniform? I think if that can happen, then we'll be able to continue to talk about free education, because at the moment we don't have it. Well, slide number 20 after 19, I've touched on it, on the issue of supporting the Nigerians. Slide number 23. Okay. That one, I'm not going to say anything about that one again. I also want to congratulate you on slide number 25. Slide number 30 on the organizational overview. I was so touched about the percentage of the female employees. I think they are really satisfying me as a woman today in this committee. You see, if ever we were to check on or give the awards on the provinces, Limpopo was going to get number one, because all the provinces are sending mail to this committee. So this one touched me indeed, and I really want to urge you to continue thinking of our women. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me also sing the very song to welcome the presentation, Chair. Chair, my question maybe will be very controversial. Will be very controversial. I just want to know, for the interest sake, with these big investors who are coming to invest in the country, do you have any obligatory policy that you have in terms of them allowing or voluntarily allowing a public property ownership or worker ownership in terms of our philosophy, our ideology? Why I'm asking this question, we are talking of a radical economic transformation agenda. And in that note, meaning we must, by any way, by now, having some obligatory policy or framework that would oblige the investors and these other big companies to allow for a communal ownership or worker ownership or public ownership of any entity that is investing in the country. That question is very controversial because it's not covered within the presentation, Chair. I'm just asking it for the sake of checking whether are we still in line with our policy position. Thank you, Chair.
Last one, Chair. Last question. I wanted to... concentrating only with the people that you're working with, or
refer to our historically disadvantaged people in the community. If ever it's like them, then how did you come up with 18? And I also want to know if ever 3 maybe are from my province. Because slide number 28, under building a high performance agency. Thank you, Chair. That one.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'll start by reminding the Honourable Entebbe that Thomas Sankara once said, if the state schools are good enough for the people, it ought to be good enough for you. What is he doing in the public schools? And I welcome the presentation, Commissioner, as well. And really, Commissioner, when you speak about graduates and how proud you are of the graduates, you say that free education is something that you obviously harbor deep within yourself, and I love that. Also, you talk of building your own organization. We also talk of building state capacity. Chairperson, the Commissioner talks like a true fighter. Thank you very much.
What kind of a fighter?
Mr. Honorable, you're not going to respond to this question at all. What I'll ask you to do is to respond to them in writing. I'll give you the deadline of next Friday to do so. Because as I indicated that we should be done by 1, because we also have a sitting this afternoon. So at least it will give you an opportunity to have more time, perhaps even give more information and contextualize some of the questions and responses. All I can do now is to thank you for coming, and I know we put pressure on you. Perhaps when we decide on the entities, we'll see whether we should have 2 entities at the same time or just 1 entity. Perhaps we look at your report, clean all the, most of the time members will focus on governance issues and that won't take long on this one. So let's include it with the ITEC. Yeah, but for now all we can do is you and your colleague to thank you for coming and do the presentation. Perhaps next time we invite you, we'll have more time to engage on this matter. But also let me take this opportunity also on behalf, I see in the report itself that we also express, I don't know when the person passed on memory of Kolela Nokele. When was it?
About
this year. We also like to express our condolences on behalf of the committee. Thank you very much for coming. We will make sure that we invite you once more, as I was indicating that the issues, as you are also indicating, are of national importance, public interest as well. We just been hearing about competition commission in media. I know in my previous life we were also, and there was this issue of, as Honorable Ntebe will remember, the issue of Sakau. And there was this retail company, I forgot its name now, Walmart, yeah. That was the issue when in my previous life that they were engaging with the in the Federation, when I was in the Federation, this issue, as well as the Sakau. Yeah. No, thank you very much. As I indicated, members, we will get responses in writing. I know some of you are disappointed with this approach, but unfortunately, we don't have time supporting the idea. Oh, thank you very much. Let me steal some of your time, members. Just we go through the minutes.
Honourable members, is just to remind and check the progress
with regard to the briefing to our legislators on the issue of the ARTO bill. So far, the Northwest has done the briefing to the Committee on Transport. Mpumalanga will be next week, or today, sorry. Limpopo will be on the 30th of November. Western Cape has already been done by Honorable Launch on the 14th of November. Eastern Cape will be on the 7th of December. Talking about briefing, you still must have public hearings on that. We want to remind these following group provinces to facilitate the issues of dates. KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, Northern Cape, and Free State. If they can facilitate a link with their PLOs here at the Constituent House, as well as perhaps the chairpersons of the portfolio committees. And also inform the PLOs as well as the committee secretary and Mr. Erasmus for logistical support as well. That was the last item. Let me thank you, honorable members, because this is our last meeting, for your cooperation throughout the year. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. No, the program still continues. This was on the eve of COVID.